Welcome to Passing Years CAM Podcast, Conversations on Era Digestive Management. This episode of CAM features your host, Dr. Kristen King, and guest, Brooke Richardson, having a conversation on implementing respiratory muscle training.
I'd like to welcome everybody to our podcast, Conversations on Area Digestive Management. Today, we're sitting down with Brooke Richardson, speech-language pathologist from North Carolina. She works in an acute care setting at UNC Rex Hospital in Raleigh, North Carolina, and she's going to be talking with us today about a number of acute care considerations, especially with implementing respiratory muscle training. But before we get into that hot topic, Brooke, I want to let you introduce yourself a little bit. And if you could share a little bit about your philosophies on educating medical SLPs.
Absolutely. First of all, thank you for having me on this podcast. I love talking about all things med SLP and RMT and acute care. So anytime I get to share my passion with the world, I just get so excited. Like you said, I am currently in acute care. I have been working in acute care my entire career, starting in my clinical fellowship, which started back in 2009. So I've been doing it for a while now. I've also had some outpatient experiences added in here and there, but I've been in acute the whole time, and I really, really love that setting. It just feels like pure speech pathology. I can do what I want when I want, for as long as I want. I can see a patient for 8 minutes or 38 minutes or 68 minutes. So there I am going down the road of how much I love acute care. But another thing that I really love doing is teaching other medical SLPs, and not just teaching them, but really preparing them to work in the medical setting, whether that's outpatient or home health or somewhere like acute care, because each setting has its own unique needs. And having interacted with as many patients and nurses and family members and other speech pathologists as I have, that there's this huge gap between a lot of continuing education or even our graduate education in the United States and what we need to know and know how to do once we're in the clinical setting, especially in acute care. And especially since a lot of the time we're working with critically ill patients, and the recommendations that we make for a patient can have significant impacts on their health and wellness and quality of life, of course. So that's a huge, huge passion area of mine. And I am now offering a membership called the Modern Med SLP membership, where every month we have a live and recorded case study so that people can learn from real world experiences from other clinicians, whether that's in the United States or around the world. Everybody is welcome. Students are welcome, so that we can all learn from each other and get feedback from each other as well, because everybody has something to offer and everybody has something to learn.
Both the idea that we need more education in the area, that's one reason why I wanted you to share a little bit about what you're doing. And also, I have a passion for education and acute care. That's where I had worked. So I am in full support and understand your passion and enthusiasm for all of it. But I do want to get into kind of the meat of what we're going to talk about today a little bit, which is that idea of working in acute care, getting started with those patients. And let's start first a little bit with just kind of getting in the door of the patient's room. You know, like, how do we get on the team? If you don't mind, I know I didn't share that with you earlier, but just a real brief, like, how you get involved with those patients and kind of get the referrals. And then we'll jump into more the diagnoses and bringing in respiratory muscle training. But I'm thinking to do it in sequence, kind of like you get in the door, you assess, and then you start the treatment. And I think of respiratory muscle training as being on the treatment end. So that's why I'm asking about how you got in the door.
For sure. Yeah. So the typical sequence of things in acute care is getting a referral from a physician or other medical provider. Typically in acute care, that's going to be for swallowing, and I don't know, probably 70% of my caseload is a swallowing evaluation. But then a good chunk of it too, especially since I've worked in the ICU or the intensive care unit for quite a bit, is going to be your trach and vent population. A smaller percentage is going to be specific for cognition or aphasia, but usually we We add that in once we get a referral from one of the other two big ones. It depends too on how your hospital is set up and what the speech pathology program has been like in the past. Some people are starting from the ground up, so you might have to really work to earn the respect. Respect is earned, right? So earn the respect of those providers and really help them understand what services you provide. But those of us who have been fortunate enough to also have a program that we're not starting from scratch, the physicians will refer us automatically because they know what services we provide. So I'll get the consult from a physician or a provider and do a really, really thorough chart review. I say that 90% of what I do in acute care is chart review and patient and family interview. That is the biggest part of being dysphagia detective or trach detective, is really having a good background of what that patient is there for, what their past medical history is, what their communication or swallowing complaints are. So really thorough chart review, talk to the nurse, maybe the respiratory therapist, maybe the physician, talk to different members of the team, get an idea because not everything's written in the chart. And then go into the room. In the ICU especially, it's really important to look at all of the equipment and the monitors in the room to see what oxygen our patient is on, how well they're doing with that amount of oxygen, how many lines and drains and what other equipment they have attached to them, because we need to know that not just from a treatment perspective, but also to not accidentally trip on things and injure the patient or destabilize the patient when we're walking around the room. So I do a good glance around the room and then start in on the patient and family interview as best I can. So that's going to be for an evaluation, certainly, but I also do that on treatment follow-ups. If I'm following up on a patient that one of my colleagues has seen, I want to introduce myself and develop a good rapport and get an idea of what their concerns are that day, even though an evaluation has already been completed.
That's a good perspective on getting in the door, and you bring up a really important point that all the information is not in the chart. I think another piece I'm going to add on to that is knowing the right questions to ask.
Absolutely.
That I think the clinician needs to know what questions to ask to get the key pieces that they need. But let's say you've done that, you've done the interview, you have your information to go in and start with the patient. Can you share a little bit about the diagnoses you typically see that may end up needing respiratory muscle training as an intervention?
Sure. So a lot of that too depends on your philosophy for therapy and acute care to begin with. A lot of times we think of like an acute stroke patient, and we expect there to be a degree of spontaneous recovery. So if it's somebody with a pretty mild dysphagia and we're not necessarily recommending traditional dysphagia therapy, we're probably not then going to recommend respiratory muscle training for that patient. So RMT is really beneficial, but it also is part of a treatment paradigm. So we really need to think about it big picture wise and not just recommend RMT to everybody, just like we wouldn't recommend the Mendelsohn to everybody. So that's tip number one. So a lot of what I do in acute care with RMT these days tends to be with my trach and vent population, people who especially now have long COVID, but you know, my respiratory failure patients who have been intubated for a prolonged period of time, or who have been intubated for a prolonged period of time and then end up having a trach and maybe continue to be ventilated for a prolonged period of time. Because I think that population is going to have such lasting effects, and they're not going to have that spontaneous recovery of their respiratory musculature like we would expect with maybe an acute stroke, a really focal weakness or a really focal impairment. So my trach and vent people, it could be that I'm doing respiratory muscle training for swallowing. It could be that I'm doing respiratory muscle training more from a cough or vocal intensity communication perspective. And the idea is that whether I'm targeting swallowing or cough or communication, the benefits are going to apply to other body systems. So they're going to benefit not just from the submental musculature perspective for swallowing, but also for hopeful vent liberation, trach decannulation. So by targeting one, we can actually see improvements transfer over to another.
I agree. I understand that in the sense we certainly see that often with a few interventions, but respiratory muscle training in particular, that it overlaps between different need areas. In speaking with that, and you mentioned the trach vent population, Can you share a little bit of the parameters? Because I often hear the question about what therapy do you do for the valve, for a speaking valve, if they're using one? And I always share there is no therapy for the valve, because right. all that does is close the system. And then you have to assess the systems. Like, as you said, you know, you have to look at the patient and what their deficit areas are. So can you share a little bit about what you see in a patient that makes you start thinking this patient may benefit from respiratory muscle training?
Yeah, definitely. So if I have done a chart review and I see that that patient has been on the ventilator for, I'm just going to say 14 days, it's a pretty long time. It's not the longest, but it's pretty long. Then I'm already going to be thinking in the back of my mind, this person has been ventilated for a prolonged period of time, especially if they also had paralytics on board, because the paralytics paralyze the respiratory muscles, so they can't override the ventilator. So by doing a chart review and seeing a prolonged ventilator use in addition to any sedation or paralytics, that's going to make me already think that they might need respiratory muscle training. Then, depending on what their swallowing study shows, if they have some of these folks with trach and vent swallow beautifully, amazingly, even though they've been critically ill. So if they don't have a swallowing impairment, then I'm going to not worry so much about addressing the swallowing part. But if I go in the room and they're really quiet and they're tolerating the speaking valve, they're really quiet and they have very short phrase lengths, like they're running out of air and it's not because of a vocal fold paresis or something like that, and they have been on the ventilator for a prolonged period of time, then I'm going to automatically start to think we need to do a respiratory muscle training evaluation. And if I can assess both inspiratory and expiratory muscle strength, it depends on how weak the person is. Sometimes they can't tolerate both evaluations at once. And if somebody is that weak, it's most likely that they're going to need the inspiratory muscle training primarily in order to help facilitate ventilator liberation, eventual trach decannulation, improve their cough strength and their vocal volume. So if they can only do one and swallowing is normal, I'm going to focus more on inspiratory muscle training.
I think that's a really good takeaway for people to use, that idea using swallowing almost as a benchmark. You know, if their swallowing looks good, then you really may focus more on inspiratory muscle training. And if they have a swallowing disorder and have some form of, especially a pharyngeal dysphagia, then you're going to look more towards potentially the expiratory muscle training, I'm assuming. You didn't say that yet, but that's what it sounded like where you were going. But I do want to mention, because where you started with that, there's that use it or lose it paradigm that we often hear, and that we see that a lot with the trach and vent population. Like you mentioned, if they've been on a ventilator for a period of time, they're not, that's a passive breathing activity with a lot of those patients, that the ventilator is doing the work. And that can lead to some disuse atrophy. We also have the issue with bed rest and the issues that arise because of bed rest and not using those muscles, not sitting up and moving and being mobile, which some patients are. It depends on the facility and the diagnosis and, you know, how quickly they get patients up. But then research has also shown disuse atrophy in the pharyngeal musculature for swallowing. So when you mentioned how long they've been on a ventilator, that's part of that consideration, like you mentioned, is that time, just that time frame of how long they've not used the muscles for whatever activity it is that's being addressed.
The literature also shows that there's no agreement on what prolonged intubation is, by the way, but generally 48 hours or so is considered prolonged-ish, but people continue to lose muscle mass in the diaphragm, which is the main inspiratory muscle, for every 12 hours, I think it is, of ventilator use. There's a certain percentage where people continue to lose that muscle mass. And the research shows that that loss continues for a long time, and it takes a very long time to try and regain that. And so people who've been intubated for even a week, for example, can still have persistent respiratory muscle weakness well after the ventilator's been removed. And I'm not suggesting that we as speech pathologists go and treat every single person who's been intubated for more than 2 days. I'm not at all suggesting that, not even possible, and not indicated. But if we have a patient who's been intubated for a prolonged period of time or vented for a prolonged period of time, and they have some sort of SLP adjacent deficit, then that's when we want to consider RMT. We don't want to just blanket throw RMT at everybody who's been on a ventilator.
Where I think of it sometimes, my kind of hallmark characteristic, I guess you'd say, is the patient who has poor breast support for speech, mm-hmm. where they're not able to either have the volume or the breast support to get out any type of phrasing or sentence. I sometimes say MLUs, which really aren't what we look. We don't look at mean length utterance with adults, but I still look at it kind of like that, because if they can only get out one or two words on a breath, and then they're having to try and take a breath, or they, after one or two words, become aphonic and have no sound to their speech, those are the patients I start looking at and I say, oh, they've got poor breath support. And I'm talking about the patient that has the history, like you've already described. That's when I start looking at respiratory muscle training. Could you talk a little bit about how you would decide IMT, EMT, or both, which you already started a little bit on, if you had that particular patient? Mm-hmm. Like you go in and that's their primary issue, is that breast support for speech?
Sure. Sometimes it's not cut and dry, because we need to have adequate air in order to speak. So we need to have adequate inspiratory strength in order to draw that air in order to speak. But we also have to have adequate expiratory force in order to speak. So some patients have both inspiratory and expiratory, and we need to decide one or the other, because a lot of times these patients can't do both inspiratory and expiratory from a strength perspective, but also a cognitive perspective. I have cognitively intact people who can't switch from one to the other. It's hard. So what I do then is I use my respiratory pressure meter to assess hopefully both their MIP and their MEP, their maximal inspiratory and their maximal expiratory pressures. And I look at those two based on that patient's performance and compare them to the norms or the predicted values for somebody, their sex, their age. And I say, okay, both their MIP and their MEP were low, they were weak, but the MIP is way, way, way weaker than the MEP compared to what would be predicted. So reasonable to say that most likely their impaired breath support for speech is because of impaired inspiratory muscle strength. Now, inspiratory muscle testing is also really challenging for people to do correctly. You know, take that with a grain of salt. But if I see a huge difference between inspiratory and expiratory strength compared to the norms, then I'm going to go ahead and choose to pursue inspiratory muscle training, assuming that fits in with their big medical picture.
Thank you. I think that helps a little bit on understanding the difference and how you might select one over the other. Do you mind talking a little bit about implementing respiratory muscle training in the acute care, like in the ICU, or even if they've come off to, say, the general floor? Did you have any barriers when you started it? Because I'm thinking of people that may not be using it yet and may face a couple of barriers to getting that started. And then what kind of treatment protocol do you set up? Are there staff trained? Do you train the patient and their family? Do only you do it? Do you mind just sharing kind of some general parameters of how you handle it?
Definitely. So there were a lot of questions there. So I'll start with starting the program, maybe. I did have barriers. I would love to say that I can do whatever I want with no barriers, but unfortunately, I have barriers to starting programs just like most other clinicians in this country / world. So when we started the program, my manager at the time was really worried that having that program, the physicians were going to get really excited about it. Like, how sweet, you think they're going to get excited about what speech is doing? Oh, she was really worried that this was going to result in this explosion in caseload and we weren't going to be able to manage all of these patients. And I had to explain that, no, we started by treating patients with dysphagia, by the way. So not the trig vent population. For a number of reasons, but just to keep things simple, we started with certain parameters. Patients had to fit these parameters in order to start the program, so we would all be on the same page. And so we explained, no, it's patients that we're already seeing for therapy. We're just adding this new, it's essentially new exercise. So it's not going to cause an explosion in caseload. Of course, there was that, which of course affects budget. So I showed that we wouldn't need any increased staffing. I showed how much the devices would cost based on a pie in the sky estimate, and we got approved and continued to track our success and how many patients we were seeing, and showed that there was no explosion in caseload, that we could afford to give out the devices. We don't charge for them at my hospital. And so we overcame that barrier by by showing the good logical decisions we'd be making for patient candidacy, and then to show that everything would be budget friendly. And as an aside, we as SLPs do not ask for things that we should be asking for. People are afraid to ask for devices. People say, oh, that device costs $1,000, $1,500 for the micro RPM that I use. And I say, yes, but physical therapy has a $30,000 bike in the corner collecting dust. They get TheraBands. They have Velcro. They have, OT has putty. I mean, there's all sorts of stuff. So my huge soapbox for SLPs is stop being afraid to ask. If you really think that you need something, that your patient needs something, ask for it. Worst they can say is no, and then you ask again. So that was part one. Part two was,
how did you implement it into acute care as a treatment protocol? Like, does SLP provide it only, or do you train patients or staff, or how do you work it into that acute care setting?
So ideally we would be training staff, but there has been so much turnover as a result of the pandemic, in addition to the general turnover that happens in acute care in general, that training staff has just not been where we've focused our energy. So we use the rule of five sets of five, 5 days of a week. And we're not seeing patients for therapy 5 days a week. I just want to put that out there. We are not staffed. I've worked in a place that is staffed for that, for every clinician to see patients 5 days a week. Great. But I know that that is a total unicorn. So that's the goal, is five sets of five, 5 days a week. And if we can, we train the care partner to help the patient. So if we can only get in there 3 days a week, and some weeks you don't know if you'll get in three, some weeks it might be once or twice or none. But if we can train the care partner, here's a handout, this is how you do it, five sets of five, check the device, make sure it's set appropriately. And, you know, maybe aim for doing this at 4 o'clock, so that if we don't have a chance to come by, you'll know that it's getting done that day. That is the best case scenario. And occasionally we have people who are cognitively intact enough to do it themselves. But for our trach and vent population, or our people who have critical illness myopathy and can't even hold the device themselves, they definitely need a care partner. So sometimes if we can, for those critically ill people who don't have care partners, sometimes we do try and see them a little bit more frequently, especially with length of stay. The goal for hospitals everywhere is to decrease that length of stay. So if we can get them off the ventilator sooner, hypothetically at least, by increasing their inspiratory muscle strength, getting them swallowing, getting them coughing, getting them pulmonary toileting on their own better, then maybe we can facilitate a faster discharge to a long-term acute care hospital, or we can facilitate decannulation and open up a whole world of opportunities for skilled nursing facilities, for home with home health. So if we can help to facilitate discharge, then we will.
And that's another good point as far as the discharge plan. And that may actually change if you can work with the patient, like you said, and get them weaned off the ventilator, because being on a ventilator certainly impacts who will take them. So even if that's all, is they get weaned off the ventilator and they're not decannulated, that's going to open things up. And if they progress even to the point of decannulation, that's going to open it up even broader as to the options for discharge planning.
Exactly.
So there's a lot of ramifications for getting in there earlier, and the sooner we can get involved in whatever aspect of care we're providing, even if it's the dysphagia aspect without RMT, you know, just getting their issues addressed sooner progresses everything sooner.
Absolutely. And I think there's been a big paradigm shift. I'm hoping it's going to happen more and more in speech, but it's definitely happening in PT and OT, is that early mobilization. And we started an early activity program in our ICU in 2019. Great timing. So that's been a little bit harder to keep up with, but that culture shift is really challenging, because it requires the whole team to be on board with getting people up and active and moving earlier, but also getting speech involved earlier. And historically, in a lot of places, speech isn't even in the ICU at all. So really important to get in there to feel confident, but carefully confident, right, in your ability to provide services and your ability to keep a patient safe. Because sometimes people are thrown into the ICU with no training and go, oh, I don't want to hurt anybody. You know, I want to be really cautious, which is fine. You know, we want to be cautious and keep our patients safe. But it's really important if you don't have that mentorship to decide really what's safe for a patient or to how to progress them or what to do in therapy with an intensive care patient, that you really get some mentorship, whether from me or from somebody else, so that you can progress those patients and you can feel more confident doing that with your future patients.
That's really a nice kind of summary ending point. It brings us right back to the beginning, where we were talking about education and the passion for the field of speech language pathology or medical speech language pathology. Also, you just brought up a really critical point. You were talking about someone's comfort level and being having a mentor, and that really boils down to having the competency to work in the area that you're working in. And to be competent, you have to have the proper training. And that's, we get training in graduate school, but that can't prepare us for everything. And so there's the additional educational opportunities that people can look at. And you're now offering, you said, case studies and things that can really help prepare people. There are educational opportunities, of course, through us. We've got live and pre-recorded education. And there's other groups that offer education. There's quite a number of continuing education groups out there. But even aside from that, you mentioned mentoring. And I think that is a critical piece to people being properly educated and having the right competencies, not just watching a course or reading a paper, but having a person that can mentor and answer questions and help guide them through their practice that they can run things by. So whether that's someone in their facility or whether they find someone outside of their facility, I think if it's a new area that they're really trying to gain skill in, it's really important to connect with a person and have that mentorship. So I'm glad you mentioned that.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I was fortunate where I had a team of SLPs around me when I was a clinical fellow. So one might recommend one thing, one might recommend the other. And it's important to have multiple people's perspectives, right? That's how we develop our own clinical reasoning too. But some people don't have that, or some people are afraid of asking a question online or talking to their own clinical fellowship supervisor, because those relationships, they can be a little bit interesting. So very important to have mentorship, whether that's, like you said, Kristen, at your facility or outside of your facility when you're learning something new.
I appreciate your time today, and I would love to have you back on.
I would love that. Yes. Thank you so much for having me today too.
Thank you for listening to this episode of CAM. We are happy to offer continuing education credit through ASHA for this podcast. To receive credit, please go to www.passymuir.com/podcast and click on the continuing education link under this episode. Then you will either create an account or log into your existing education portal account. Complete the quiz and course evaluation for your podcast episode. Your certificate will be available for download once completed.